Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Hive. We got me, James, doing the hosting this week because Aaron's busy with work and Pete has gone missing online. So yeah, hopefully it's not a train wreck. And I guess we'll welcome Joseph Nation at JNL1 on Twitter first. How are you doing, Joe?
Good. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. As always, pretty excited to record Beyond the Hive. And this week, because the aforementioned two other Hornets fanatics are missing, we've decided to get a special guest. He writes for Beechtree Hoops. His Twitter handles at Willis_Glenn. And it's, you can get it from that. But it's Glenn Willis, one of the best Hawks analysts. Well, the best Hawks analyst I know personally. So how are you doing, Glenn?
Yeah, appreciate the kind words. Thanks for having me on. Look forward to chatting this up with you guys.
Glenn is, I don't know what time it is for Glenn, but I think it's something like 4 or 5 a.m. So, 6 a.m.
Yeah.
He's a dad, you know, so, you know, really appreciate him coming on at this time. So yeah. So to start, we're just going to do a quick recap of the Hornets. It's been at least a month, if not more, since the last episode of Beyond the Hive. And in that time, a lot of stuff has happened, you know. The favorite for the Rookie of the Year award in the NBA, LaMelo Ball, got injured, obviously, and he's going to miss at least the rest of the regular season. And then, Gordon Hayward got injured. I'm a bad Hornets fan. I don't exactly know what part of the body he injured.
Ankle,
look that up now.
I think. No, he was the foot.
Yeah,
it was Malik's foot originally, and then Malik managed to have his foot cause his ankle to be injured.
Yes.
And now Gordon's foot is injured.
Okay, yes. So what Joe said about Malik had a bit of shit luck, and then Hayward's had a foot sprain. So basically, we've been down, three of our best players for the last few weeks, although James Borrego probably based a diff on the Malik Monk being one of the Hornets' best players at this point, but we ignore that. So yeah, it's been a very similar roster to the roster that played for the Hornets post-All-Star break last season. Miles and PJ both starting at the same time again, which has been cool to see. And then, yeah, me and Joe's boy, Jalen McDaniels, has been inserted as a starting forward, small forward, to very successful results. So, Joe, what's your thoughts on how the Hornets season's tracking?
Yeah, I mean, the McDaniels part is exactly as obvious as it would have seemed to be. He's, he's still a little bit defensively over-aggressive, but is still worlds better in every way than either Martin Twin. And, you know, last night's game was particularly egregious for the Martins, but even before then, like, their best games make it clear that, like, there was no way they ever should have been playing over Jalen, and that really shouldn't have ever been in doubt. In general, though, like, the Hornets are rounding into this position where it's like, okay, well, if we can tread water long enough, yeah, we might actually end up as the 4 seed. You know, we've got a tiny cushion over teams that are almost definitely better than us, but you live with that. And practically speaking, it is entirely conceivable that we will in fact have home court against, again, a team better than us, but a team not better than us by enough to where we couldn't beat them given home court. It's a good season, even if there are some, you know, issues, in the sense that, yes, we're still playing the Martin Brothers minutes. We just, you know, have nobody else because everybody's hurt. So
I mean, I look at that rotation that we played the last two games, and I just think, you know, you take out the Martin twins, you take out Wanamaker. You know, I know he's gotten a bit of love from Hornets Twitter, but, you know, let's be realistic. He's like a 6'3". You know, he's a 6'3", 6'2", I don't know what he is. He's a point guard size, non-point guard player who does his best work attacking closeouts on offense, I guess, except he's not super great. You know, he's not got a great first step, and he's not an amazing finisher at the rim. And, you know, he's an okay role player, especially for what his role was in Boston, you know, playoff Kemba and Jason Tatum. But, you know, I think you replace him and the Martin twins with, you know, Monk, Hayward, and then hopefully we can get LaMelo back for the playoffs. And it starts to look like, yeah, a team that might be able to win a playoff series.
For what it's worth, like, when we traded for Wanamaker, I don't think we were expecting him to be anything more than the third guard on this team. And then, Hayward gets hurt, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's
when I say, sorry, not third guard, third point guard.
Yeah.
Like those guys typically you want to have on the roster, but you never play them. And honestly, like when we traded for him, I expected him to be about Martin level. He's been clearly better than the Martins.
Oh no. Yeah. So he's, yeah, no. He's a top player. Cause yeah, like he actually is like, cause I watch a bit of Dubs basketball this year and like, he's actually pretty good at switching up, you know, pretty strong frame. So, and we do have the playmakers kind of to, you know, make him play a more off-ball role. And yeah, I mean, so in that regard, you know, now that we're playing small a lot more with PJ at the five, it's actually not a bad acquisition in terms of just fit with what the team does. So, you know, yeah, pretty solid acquisition. And yeah, he's giving us solid minutes right now, but yeah, hopefully you're not relying on him too much in a playoff series. So Joe just mentioned, yep, the Hornets are fourth seed right now, I believe. Yep, so Atlanta is the fifth seed, and yeah, that is the team that our man Glenn Willis covers. So, yeah, Glenn, how do you how about from like an outsider's perspective, how do you view the Hornets as a playoff threat?
Yeah, it's been interesting to watch the Hornets this year, especially the last few weeks or month or what have you, because they just keep taking injuries and they just keep winning. And it's funny, as I hear from Hawks fans pretty consistently, it's like, when are they going to stop winning? There's this expectation, I think probably around the league, that they're just going to eventually kind of run out of gas, considering the fact that they're best two players are down, you know. So I think everybody is just kind of waiting for them to fall off, and they just haven't yet. So it's been interesting, you know. But when I watched them play, it's just fascinating to me, like how simplified everything is for the team, and how that kind of works for where they are, and trying to kind of build up towards being a very good team, you know, maybe next year or whenever that might be realistic. The switching and zone-based defense, playing kind of a lot of five out and just attacking the paint, driving kick, driving kick, driving kick, and all that sort of stuff. I mean, it's basic, like really simple stuff, but it's perfect to me for kind of the roster that they have right now. When it comes to the playoffs, you know, I think they have to have LaMelo and Hayward back kind of full force if they really want to have an opportunity to kind of win a first round. And then, you know, I think the realistic view of them is similar to the Hawks. It's like they need to draw a favorable matchup to have kind of a nice shot to maybe win a first round series. We'll come down to who that opponent is. And of course that'll come down to, you know, can they land maybe in the fourth seed and get home court and maybe draw, you know, a matchup that's not against the big three. So it's their resilience and their ability to kind of keep finding ways to win has been really impressive. Even if I admit that I sometimes scratch my head, like, how do they keep doing this?
The thing that like cheapens this kind of analysis to me about a head coach is because a lot of analysts just throw it out there for any coach, but James Borrego genuinely will, you know, get the guys to play hard, and he'll get, you know, he'll draw a lot of effort out in these type of games, even when the roster's down. Because, as I said, last year the roster post All-Star break, it's not the best roster in the first place. But then you lose Malik, who's really finding his hitting stride then, and then you lost Cody Zeller, didn't play a lot of those games, and you're running a center rotation of Bismack Biyombo and Billy Hernan Gomez, because Borrego wasn't willing to play PJ at the five at that time. So, but we still had a number of, you know, really impressive performances. I think we beat the Raptors in Toronto, and yeah, it was actually genuinely fun basketball then. So yeah, you know, it's definitely impressive to see Borrego just, you know, just repeat that, I guess. Show it wasn't entirely a fluke.
And it's completely uncoincidental that it comes exactly when he's, yeah, pared down the schemes, made them back to as simple as possible, and, you know, taken as many complex things out of Terry's hands as possible.
I'm not going to lie, like, I need to get off my chest. Like, the fact that we went back to point guard Terry probably around February or so was just one of the more head-scratching things, because at that time, like, you know, we were down players, but we still had Malik, we still had LaMelo, but yeah, we went back to point guard Terry without Devontae and Hayward, which was Yeah, questionable. But yeah, like gone away.
Is that when the shift happened?
Sorry, what?
Is that when the shift happened?
Well, I don't remember because I don't think I've been the most diligent Hornets fan this year, but I do remember just like before the All-Star break, those games against Phoenix, Portland, like, yeah, like Terry was getting getting the ball a lot at the top of the key, you know, bring the ball up and attempting to get the team into actions. So,
that's right. Like, in my mind, actually, no, because the Phoenix game was after the LaMelo injury, right? Yeah, it was.
Talking about the first one where we beat them.
Oh, okay, yeah. That one.
If you're talking about the one where Miles threw down like 5 dunk contests, 50 level dunks, that would be post All-Star break. But this one we're talking about, the one where, you know, Malik dropped like 29 and LaMelo like scored 2 clutch ISO buckets on noted, supposed good perimeter defenders, DeAndre Ayton and Jay Crowder.
Yeah, that was an interesting end of the game rather. But yeah, I mean, in general though, like I tend to think that Terry full switching back to point guard as he did tended to happen more after the LaMelo injury. Okay. Like it was still coming back a little bit, but most of it's been like it's been much more clear after LaMelo got injured and especially after Monk got injured because well duh. But yeah. And I think mostly, like, we've mostly seen it with, like, you know, when it's him and a Martin brother on the court, which, you know, those lineups should have never been happening anyway.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Well, okay. Well, I'm just going to ask Glenn, like, what's the most head-scratching lineup you've seen from Atlanta Hawks perspective this season to rival Terry Rozier, Caleb Barn, and backcourt?
Any lineup that had Rondo in it, probably while he was on the team. and, you know, the Hawks are pretty deep with veteran players this year. Yeah. I mean, we could talk about whether they use their cap space wisely and at the right time. That's very debatable. Committing a lot of money to a team that, you know, needs more room to grow and needs some more flexibility to kind of get to where they probably want to be, you know, down the line a little bit. But I was not excited about the Rondo experience coming in, thought he was a terrible fit for what they wanted to do. You're talking about a team that's built around the Trae Young pick and roll, and Rondo doesn't want to run a single pick and roll anymore at this phase. Stage of his career, so they had to run a completely different offense when he was on the court. So it was more around kind of that fit that was problematic. But they don't have a lot of players that they throw out there that you're like, oh man, what is he doing, you know, in the game? Okwangwu had a rough start, but I think you have to expect that when you draft a one and done big, that if you're going to play him, sure, to let him get reps, that you're going to kind of tolerate, you know, what kind of comes along with that. So apart from Rondo and some ugly Congo minutes, it's been fine, but I think that has more to do with just having some roster depth than the coaching staff, you know, being brilliant about, you know, putting, you know, right, really cohesive lineups together.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that, like, I still think that Dwayne Dedmon, I don't know what your thoughts are on Dedmon, Glenn, but I watched him last year for the Kings, and just, you know, I probably should not, you know, keep the hit list to a minimum because I, you know, pot enough people every edition of this podcast. But Dedmon was not my favorite player on the Kings. Sure. But to turn him into Tony Snell, I just thought it was really solid because even if you think they're similar caliber players, I just think Snell, like, he's been like a low usage spot up wing who plays defense for like plus 5 years of his career maybe, and he's done it well. So like I just thought getting that kind of move on the margins, you know, seems to a good locker room dude as well. And as you know, like he's come in he started like for a while now, right? And he's done all right. Yep. So
Nate's moved Herter back into the starting lineup, which has been interesting, a bit of unexpected change. Part of that might be to give Lou someone to work with on the second lineup. So he's kind of looking at Lou, Snell and Gallo kind of trying to be a cohesive kind of second unit team. But I mean, Dedmon forgot how to shoot in Sacramento to start with. And then, I don't think he ever felt it. Looked to me like, having watched him for a couple of years in Atlanta, he looked to me like he didn't buy into what Luke was doing out there.
And that would, and obviously that'd be totally fair because, geez, where do we even start?
And I mean, there's also always the complication, like Sacramento asks their bigs to be more mobile and Dedmon is not.
I mean, we say that and then, I don't think Dedmon's like, lack of mobility was like super jarring, and I don't think he's like super slow plotter type anyway. Although, as I said, like whenever he came on the court, I pretty much tried to turn it off. I don't really think Alex Lane was ended up being a whole lot better, even though Kings fans still really love him. Me and Joe are extremely critical of James Borrego, as most listeners would know. I think I pot him. I literally try to keep my Borrego criticism down, but sometimes, you know, it just gets let out anyway. So, you know, every probably week or so or a few days or so, you'll see some Borrego criticism on my timeline. And I think my handle was #FireJamesBorrego for a bit there. But, we're not the biggest fans of what Borrego's done. Atlanta's obviously turned it around recently with Nate McMillan. How much do you say, would you say is of that is, you know, tangible Nate McMillan coaching, and how much is it, could it be just, you know, the new coach glow or some of those, or it could have just be random luck, you know, easy schedule, that sort of thing?
Yeah, so I think it's pretty equal parts favorable schedule, and you know, not sure how closely Hornets fans pay attention, but you know, they went on an 8-game West Coast road trip, went 4-4, which is a totally fine outcome for the kind of team that they are. But you know, got some luck, like LeBron got hurt early in the second quarter in the game. They played the Lakers. They had some other kind of luck as well in terms of. Zion didn't play, you know, and they went through New Orleans and things like that. So they had some luck there. You know, I think Nate does deserve some credit for getting them to play steadier basketball. They were pretty atrocious fourth quarter team the whole season until the coaching change happened. And so it can be hard to know, you know, what to attribute that to at times, but you know, Nate's obviously a significantly more experienced coach than Lloyd Pierce was. And it just could be that the team just kind of trusts him considering how much experience he has and how kind of steady he seems to be, you know, as a voice and as a personality for the team. I'm not the world's biggest Nate McMillan fan, kind of in the big picture, but in terms of the Hawks and their ownership seeming to have, like, serious goals this year for wanting to get into the playoffs and maybe make some noise in the playoffs, I think Nate is the better fit and brings more immediately. Although on the flip side of that, I was very vocal about the fact that I don't think Lloyd Pierce got a kind of a fair shot to show what he can do. You know, they brought in 9 new players this year. His first 2 seasons, they had no intent of winning games, you know. You know, bringing 9 new players in with no preseason, you know, there was no summer league for the young guys to kind of get them incorporated. And then they were injured a ton all the way up until the coaching change happened. And then guys started not only coming back, but then kind of getting into playing shape and playing condition. So I think it's almost like equal thirds, the schedule favorability, better, steadier coaching, you know, from a game management perspective, and then just getting guys back healthier and getting them into better playing condition. It's, I honestly would just break it down to kind of those being equally, you know, a third attribution. So,
just quickly, you mentioned like steadier. So I haven't watched a lot of Hawks this year. So you mentioned like steadier play in the fourth quarter. So like, and I've watched a lot of unsteady fourth quarter basketball. Just one first quarter through fourth quarter basketball, to be honest, the last couple of seasons with the Walton Kings and the Saunders Timberwolves. So would you attribute that just like, does the team have a better idea of what sets them running? you know, every time they're going down the court? Or is there like better execution, for example, when, you know, Trae Young gets trapped at 30 feet? Because I know you've been vocal on that being a weakness of the Hawks this season.
Yeah, so having moved Bogdanović back into the starting lineup has given them the best kind of outlet to have a playmaker and a guy that can facilitate when Trae is kind of taken away by the defense, and that's helped a lot. But I think maybe the most positively impactful thing Nate has done is that he'll play lineups with Trae that can kind of get into their actions really quickly and attack a defense before it's set. Okay. Where when you're running Gallo on the second unit, and even to a degree, Lou, you know, he runs stuff that is similar. It's based on the pick and roll. You'll see some, a lot of wedge action, and he's running a ton more floppy. You know, so he's made a lot of X's and O's changes. But when he has the second unit on the floor, he calls things that take a little more time to kind of get into, and that's like Gallo's speed, and it works really well for Gallo. Yeah. Gallo doesn't move well at all at this point in the career. And so he just seems to have a really good feel for it's not that it's like brilliant X's and O's. I don't think anyone's going to ever accuse Dave McMillan of being this awesome X's and O's coach, but just having a feel for what kind of action suits a lineup that's on the court at any given time. And I think that the players just look like they're confident in what they're being asked to do in the fourth quarter, where before it looked like, just from observation, it looked like they weren't really confident in what Lloyd Pierce was asking them to do in the fourth quarter.
Okay, cool. So Glenn brought up a pretty interesting point there about, you know, just running actions that are suited for your players. I just want to ask Joe, like, how would you say Borrego stacks up in that regard? Like, that's pretty much it.
Well, it's interesting because, like, before I get into Borrego, if those were the reasons why Lloyd Pierce was fired, those would have been viable reasons. The problem is those were not the reasons Lloyd Pierce was fired. Lloyd Pierce, from what I've heard, was more fired due to, and this being stuff from, you know, other front office people, not in Atlanta. So, you know, grain of salt there, but, you know, was fired more due to specifically his relationship with Trae, which less good of a, you know, path to take. You know, so that's kind of the tricky part with any coaching evaluation, is that a lot of times the reasons why he's getting evaluated are not going to necessarily be the reasons why he should be getting evaluated. Which is, you know, when you launch into Borrego, you know, practically speaking, Borrego has very much not, like, I mean, we've talked about this in the past. Borrego doesn't suit his schemes to his players at all. He just runs random stuff until something works. And sometimes he keeps running random stuff even after something works. Most of the time he keeps running random stuff after something works. And so, like, you know, right now, for example, the daily special is Miles running pick and roll actions, right? And that is something that is well suited to Miles' skill set. It's something we've never seen Borrego input before. And you kind of worry that it's not going to actually be there in, you know, 2 weeks. Right now, PJ's role, even though it was allegedly just changed, and you can somewhat see that PJ is, when he's playing the five, spacing more, which is his biggest mismatch. That is a necessary personnel adjustment to what PJ does well when he's at the five, right? So that is, at some degree, matches to the, okay, well, he's doing things that more suit his players at the positions they're playing. Except PJ is also still posting up a, you know, fair amount, even at the five, against, you know, full-size centers that he can't actually post up. PJ is a valid post-up threat, but from the four, when he's matched up with smaller guys who he can go through or go over. And so that's kind of the tricky thing with Borrego, is that, well, practically speaking, he very often finds sets that happen to match up to a player's skill set. The problem is that very often he abandons those so quickly and just kind of goes to, okay, well, we need our three and four to do this, so they're going to do that. And when those happen, you know, you get you get cases like, say, Terry Rozier at point guard. That's a byproduct of, like, okay, well, we need our point guard to do this, and therefore we're going to run out, you know, whoever it is to do it, even if they can't actually do it. That's kind of where Borrego is in that regard, where it's like, well, yes, he quite often does things that match up to player skill sets quite well. But it's unclear that he understands why he's doing those things, which results in often abandoning the positive results there. And
I've said it before on Twitter, but yeah, I totally agree. And you know, as things with me, the Malik Monk guy, you know, often end up, it comes back to Malik Monk. Like, have we seen Malik, like when he checks in, do we ever see him run off like a wide pin down or a sagging screen or something? Like, he's pretty much just comes in, jump in the corner, you know, that sort of thing. Whilst he has Terry Rozier running that 1-5 pick and roll where he's often, you know, he misses the pocket pass window. So he picks his dribble up, you know, brings it back over his head like that. Kicks it back out to Biz, who then has to run another DHO with the Martin twin or something, you know, garbage like that. But so I got a question for Glenn and Joe here. We're talking about coaches, and from the perspective of us who are, you know, we're basketball fans, we're basketball analysts, but okay, so more from the people, I don't know how many, if Glenn has connections with the Atlanta front office or any other front office personnel. I know Joe might have, but like, so from the perspective of one who doesn't have that insider knowledge, you know, how do you evaluate an NBA head coach? Is it fair to evaluate an NBA head coach at all? And given, you know, stuff like politics in the locker room, you know, stars run the league too, right? So, let's say like some teams running a suboptimal, you know, playbook for their personnel, but the star is demanding the coach run that playbook, you know, is the head coach not doing the proper thing there, you know, catering to the star player? Just stuff like that. So how is a fair way to evaluate a head coach from the non-insider perspective? Is it fair at all to do that? So I'll just start with Glenn again, because we'll, you know, alternate.
But I like the way you framed the question, because it is interesting to think about how fair is it for us to criticize. And to clarify for listeners, I don't have any connections to Atlanta's front office or anyone else's front office. I live in Washington State on the West Coast, so I'm not even really around the team. Moved out here recently. You guys will find it interesting. Maybe I live like 15 minutes from where the McDaniels kids went to high school.
All right,
so not a lot about those guys. But I think it's fair to be critical of what you see. I think what you hear, depending upon how connected you might be. And I don't know personally, I don't interact with any front office people, but I know a lot of people that are in that role where they do. And they trust me with information at times and things like that. So it's not like I can run out on Twitter and share, you know, anything that I'm hearing, but it's good. Yeah. It's good contextual, I think, information. You know, for me personally, this is just my own kind of personal approach, is I really kind of try to start with what the goal for any given season is, because that's really going to impact kind of what you're seeing. So, for example, year one, year two under Lloyd Pierce, clearly development was the highest priority. Winning games was not. And I think he did a good job, a good solid job of doing that. He really gave Trey a lot of things that would help him build. It's a ton of repetitions. They played fast. He lived with a lot of errors, a high turnover rate, all that sort of stuff. If you look at
James Brager, could you please listen up on that one?
Yeah. And, you know, if you buy kind of what we've seen out of DeAndre Hunter this year in the games he's played outside of his injuries, he'd have to feel like that's been a success as well. We'll see how much of that is real when we get a bigger, you know, sample size and all that sort of stuff. And so, you know, I feel like Pierce deserved a lot of credit for being willing to go through losses, play the young guys, give them opportunities to make mistakes and kind of learn from mistakes. And then all of a sudden this season, the goal flipped to the ownership saying we want to be in the playoffs and be kind of a real team this year and make winning probably a higher priority than development, even though Trey is still the number one priority in the organization, is kind of getting him to continue developing along, being an impactful player. And so that's one of the reasons I thought, you know, a lot of the fans hated what the job Lloyd Pierce was doing this year. I pushed back kind of constantly on the fact that when they were losing earlier in the year, that I didn't really see any coaching issues, that at least not being the highest things on the list of things that were keeping them from winning games, in my view. So, yeah, I think it's fair to criticize. I think it's mature to kind of be a little measured in that, because I've never been an NBA coach. Yeah, I've never had to deal with the politics of it and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, fair. But I think that it's great to kind of be a little bit measured. But if folks, guys like us, aren't going to talk about what we like and don't like in terms of what we're seeing from coaches, who's going to do that, really? I mean, we're interested in the X's and O's. We're interested in schemes. We're interested in rotations and things like that. So, you know, if anyone's going to talk about it, might as well be someone like us, I think.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, that's a pretty good answer. Yeah, there's that classic, you know, if you follow Glenn for a long time like me, you'll know, you know, that's a classic Glenn, you know, mature, you know, reasoned sort of perspective that a 20-year-old male, a 21-year-old male like me might not have. So that's, you know, that's something I'll learn as I go on. But
I have had at 21. So
okay, yeah, cool. Yeah, fair. Yeah, continuing on, Joe, what's your perspective for that question?
Yeah, so I mean, generally speaking, there is enough information on the court at any given point in time to be able to see at least something about a coach. There are things that happen in practice that we're not privy to. There are politics between front office and owner and coach that, you know, I mean, I may get bits and pieces of, but like even the level of connection that I have, which is much more than the average fan and still nothing at all, is not enough to be able to really judge a coach off that. But I can consistently watch and see that, okay, Malik Monk is very obviously one of our best players. I can very consistently watch and see, oh yeah, Jalen McDaniels is clearly better than the Martin twins and might honestly be better than Miles Bridges most of the time.
You're still running with that, even after Miles'
breakout season. I'm still running with that, yes. Although, like, Miles has improved significantly, so either way. I can watch, even in garbage time, Vernon Carey was clearly showing more things, like a better understanding of what he needed to be doing on offense than Biz has in his entire career. Those are things that, you know, those are personnel decisions, but even things like, okay, well, do we have the personnel to play this blitzing scheme? No, we clearly don't. It's clearly not a thing that's going to work ever, and it's clearly not something we can do rotationally. Is it silly to take Malik Monk off the court in crunch time? Well, maybe. That one's a little more complicated because we're extremely successful in crunch time, and we're successful for reasons that Malik Monk doesn't necessarily change as much. Mostly because, well, you know, the extra shooter is good, but sometimes it's just a matter of, like, running your standard offense that, you know, adding Malik Monk as a third guard could break, but maybe not. But the point by and large here is that there are things you can see on the court consistently that are enough to judge a coach based on. And more often than not, those are the primary things that an organization should be making decisions on because, well, practically speaking, you know, what an organization's incentives are all on the court. You know, if you cannot translate what's happening in practice into what's actually going on the court, then practically speaking, you know, the organization doesn't benefit from an organization can have the best practice ever in existence, and it will never benefit them in the slightest other than how it pans out on the court. So if it's not panning out on the court, then, you know, that's fair for especially us outside fans to judge. I think Atlanta's a good example of stuff that, like, okay, well, practically speaking, some of the issues that Atlanta has relating to their coach are things that, yeah, fans aren't going to see. But I don't think that's necessarily right for the coach, necessarily. So, like, you know, if Lloyd Pierce is getting fired because he's not playing lineup suited to his personnel, good. You know, that's – obviously you don't want to root for anyone to lose their job, but at the same time, like, you know, organizations need guys who will put guys in the right position. If Lloyd Pierce is getting fired because he asked Trae Young to play defense, that's a little more problematic. And so that's kind of the issue, is that, like, more often than not, I think if you're going to make decisions based on what we can't see, then you're going to make the wrong decision. But if you're going to not make decisions based on what we as fans, as the general public, or, you know, as just consistent people following the team with good X's and O's knowledge, if you're making decisions on what we can see, or if you're not making decisions on what we can see, then you're probably not really evaluating things appropriately. And I get at some level that the people making these decisions, the idea is that the coach is supposed to be better at the things that happen on the court than the people who are making the decisions to hire or fire the coach. You know, practically speaking, the coach should be the best X's and O's person in any given building. That's not always the case. It's just not reality. And so you kind of end up with these limitations of, okay, well, there's organizational structure stuff, but in general, there should be enough information on the court, and the person making the decision about the coach's job and what they do should be good enough at evaluating what's going on the court to actually be able to make that decision. And the result of that is that fans, also given that same information, that same level of qualification, should also be able to turn around and be like, okay, what this coach is doing is clearly not working. We need to move on. And I think that's generally where we are, is that, yes, it's a little bit overconfident to say, oh, yeah, there's just nothing out there that we can't see, because there is information that we don't get. You know, the fact that I didn't the fact that I learned why Carey, by and large, wasn't playing far later, being political as it is, you know, that's stuff that we don't get and isn't necessarily great to act on. But there's enough information on the court there to, you know, to support what's going on behind the scenes. And that's kind of what you want, is that if there's information behind the scenes, it has to be supported by what's on the court. It's worth considering, but only insofar as it affects what's on the court. And okay, if it doesn't affect what's on the court, you know, I realize, as a member of the public, it's a little bit arrogant to say this, but I really don't care. And so that's kind of, it's not a particularly nuanced take, and there is, you know, more that you could dive into it. But in general, I think that it is good to, as outside people, be focused on, okay, well, we can judge coaches from that, even if, yeah, it's going to be an incomplete judgment at some level.
Yeah, fair enough. By the way, Glenn, if you've got anything to, you know, any points Joe brings up that you want to debate, just jump right in, because, you know.
I mean, I think Joe had a lot of good points there. And you know, when it comes to sort of, there's the team and there's what we see on the court, but there's also this sort of organizational infrastructure that has to be built up for a team to kind of be able to pursue success. And going back to kind of the Lloyd Pierce example, the hilarious part to me is that he catered to Trey so much in terms of, you know, X's and O's play calls, letting him be on ball all the time, never really challenging him to do work off ball, and things like that. And he and Trey, by all reports, just could not get along. You know, and if you think about what Atlanta moved on from in Pierce, not saying he's even above average coach, I think it would be premature to judge him kind of one way or the other on that. You know, he's basically the assistant coach on Team USA, and every organization, for example, is trying to get their reach into where all of the best players are. And we've seen, you know, for example, Team USA be a place where players kind of develop relationships and pair up, and, you know, and so I think that some folks in the Hawks space were hoping, like, well, having Coach Pierce being part of Team USA could really be a positive thing for the Hawks in terms of maybe one day pulling a, you know, big free agent and things like that. So there's so many different dynamics and factors going on at all times. It's just interesting to me, but it's, in a way, Pierce being part of Team USA ended up hurting his opportunity, I think, to stick with the organization, because Trey, and even more vocally, Trey's dad, did not like Lloyd Pierce's answers to the media when Trey didn't make Team USA last year, or it wasn't on the short list, or what have you. So there's so many moving parts. There's so many different factors. To Joe's point, a lot of those things we can see, some of those things we can't see. We have to rely on people who are actually there and kind of connected and kind of report back. But even all the reporting we hear is influenced, if not manipulated, by people that want a certain narrative to kind of be what comes out. So it's hard, but sometimes the way that it's hard makes it more fun in some ways.
Yeah, no, for sure, for sure. Yeah, so I guess one of the last things we'll talk about before Joe has to head off is do you see either the Hawks or the Hornets just doing anything in the playoffs, and maybe what their most favorable matchup, you know, out of the chasing pack and even the top three, if they were to get into the second round, is. But maybe for the favorable matchup, you can focus on your own team if you want. So, yeah, Joe, I'll probably start with you there. But, yeah, you can comment on both teams. So, yeah, Joe, what do you think the Hawks or the Hornets can do this playoffs?
I mean, practically speaking, the second round is going to be a buzzsaw for anyone, basically outside of the top three. And even practically speaking, I mean, one of the top three teams will have to play another one. So even one of them will probably have a ridiculous first round or ridiculous second round matchup. In terms of like the first round, I do think that like the Hawks and Hornets are in a position where the other two teams likely to make the playoffs in that like 4-5-6 range are presumably the Celtics and the Heat. I think that the in general, I would say that the Hawks match up better with the Celtics and the Hornets match up better with the Heat. But I don't necessarily know that that's like, you know, all of those teams are in the same general. Okay, well, I could see a playoff series between any of those four teams going in any given direction, basically. I think that basically the advantage that, I mean, the advantage that Capella provides, because in terms of like the matchup versus the Celtics, where they're not really playing a real center, is actually notable. Whereas against like the teams that are more willing to go small, he's not as big an advantage, even though he is, I mean, he has in his past been relatively mobile for a center, but again, the injuries have kind of taken that out of him.
Wait, so did you say the Hawks match up better with Boston?
Yeah.
So the team that played Grant Williams at the five for Pitts last season, and he's willing to play Marcus Smart at the five even sometimes. Like, don't you think they'd be quite willing to go small?
They're quite willing to go small, but when they go small, it looks very different than when Charlotte or Miami go small, because when Charlotte and Miami go small, it's based around a center that's able to play make on their own.
Okay.
Whereas like Smart at some level, yes, but the Smart lineups, the Smart of the five lineups are a gimmick that you don't really need.
Yeah, for sure.
More than like, you know, like you plan for those, but you're not like panicking for them.
Yep.
Grant Williams at the five, like, because he's, you know, still very much developing, you don't necessarily worry as much about him just completely breaking down everything defensively. Especially
given very PC way of saying he's shit, but yeah.
For now. But yeah,
we're not going to get into that sort of stuff. But I think, right. But I need to say, I think some draft people had Grant Williams above PJ Washington. Just to reiterate, so. Yeah.
But yeah, so generally speaking, I think that out of those teams, I suspect that the Hornets are probably the weakest, just realistically speaking. But I don't think it's to a degree that, you know, home court couldn't shift it to a slightly Hornets advantage series against any of them. I also don't think that it's, you know, to an extent that practically speaking, you know, we could just get blown out and, you know, never really be in any of these games, because practically speaking, especially with like Boston and Miami, like they have the talent, they just don't really have things coordinated right now and have lots of injury issues. So, you know, it's, but I mean, it's not like the Hornets and Hawks don't also have their injury issues to a wide degree. All four of these teams have been among the most injured in the league. Actually, that's not true. The Hornets have been one of the least injured, but they're currently injured. Regardless, though, like playoff wise, like there are very few series in the NBA where legitimately anything can happen. It's one of the most deterministic sports in existence. But in general, I mean, with those four teams, yeah, I could genuinely see a playoff series between them going either way. Part of that is a, okay, well, whoever is winning it is probably getting killed in the next round. And you realize that and you kind of accept it. And I don't think either of them has a chance against, say, the Bucks. But, you know, especially the Bucks, let alone the 76ers or the Nets.
Did we not just Oh, have we not swept the season series against the Bucks this season?
I believe we're 2-0 right now. I haven't looked at it,
right.
And I don't know if we have a third game.
Obviously,
but
to be fair, you know, beating the Thanasis led, you know, the Bucks where Thanasis is starting is probably not very ready for
right. Yeah, no, they sat their six best players last night. No, the actually I say that Portis is probably one of their six best players. Either way, and I do think like if the Hornets are somehow going to beat one of the top three, it is probably the Bucks. Just because, yeah. Like, you know, if you're going to beat one of those teams, you're basically going to have to do it by getting hot from three, and the Bucks are the team most likely against which to get hot from three. But generally speaking, probably not beating any of those teams.
And that's
just the reality of the situation for the, you know, for the middle of the East right now is, like, the East has very much got a clear, you know, separation at the top, and that is, I mean, that is how the situation breaks down. It's a very deterministic league at some point in some cases, and the second round will likely be one of those cases. So yeah, you know, it is what it is, but even one playoff series would very much be, you know, a huge thing for either of our franchises, just because, you know, the Hawks have spent the last 2 years trying to, you know, do whatever. In some respects for the Hawks, it might actually be kind of a winner's curse because it means they probably have to pay Nate McMillan full time. And I'm not sure that's the right decision either. But you know, for like, in terms of like fan sentiment, you know, a playoff series win would feel very good for either of those teams. And that's a pretty good place to be.
Yeah. Well said. Yeah, Joe, if you need to just head off, just, you know, fire something in the chat or something, but, yeah. So Glenn, yeah, what do you think about these two teams' prospects?
Yeah, I agree completely with Joe that the Celtics are the best matchup for the Hawks because basically, if the opposing team doesn't have a rim protector on the court, the Hawks just feast at the rim. You know, they're able to generate so many shots at the rim through their high screen and roll and having bigs that can dive to the rim. It's just super problematic. Now, you know, if the Celtics get Kemba and Tatum kind of really firing on all centers off all cylinders five offensively, you know, the Hawks have been playing for a long time without any of their point attack defenders. That should be Hunter, Reddish, and, you know, even though he's never played this season yet, Chris Dunn, were by design, were supposed to be the guys that, you know, take those types of assignments. And so that'll have the availability of any of those guys would have a major impact on what the actual likelihood that the Hawks could maybe take the series from the Celtics. But if you ask me about matchups, I think Joe's exactly right. He hit on that. Miami, it's interesting to me in that I think what they present that's tough for the Hawks is that they're just so physical and that has a pretty massive impact on Trey. At times, that's not to say Trey shies away from that. He does not at all. Trey tries to dish out, you know, a lot of physicality in his own way. But I think that it would be a completely different dynamic in a playoff series to have them continue throwing Jimmy Butler at him, and then, you know, Iguodala at him, and you know, we can go on and on. They have a reason now, and such. So, and then
Trey better pack an extra 10 sets of shorts, I think, for that one.
Yeah, right.
Leggings or whatever, you know, the, yeah.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Which one did he pull? Anyway, yeah.
So that would be interesting to me. But in the last couple seasons, the Hawks have had some success against Miami, but then you always kind of go back and like, okay, how seriously was Miami taking Atlanta kind of in those regular season matchups? And I also agree with Joe that kind of looking at a second round is almost fait accompli for kind of either team, but we'll still watch the games and hope that it's, you know, competitive and that they kind of find maybe an angle that we didn't think they had in terms of kind of a path to maybe getting, you know, starts with getting a win. And then if you get a first win, getting a second win, and then all of a sudden, if you get two wins, you never know what might happen the rest of the way. Sure. And such, but I think the real goal for both the Hawks and the Hornets is just to get legitimate playoff experience this year. And that's what would probably be the most limiting factor is that it's, there's no way at any level, you know, I've coached, you know, at the AU level, and if I take a team to a tournament that's never played a tournament, they have no idea what they're going to encounter until they've been through a few tournaments. And right. There's not a ton of parallels between that level and the NBA, but the one parallel I think works is that until an NBA team as a unit has gone through how different the game is in the playoffs, how differently it's officiated, how different the tempo is, all the kind of different things. It's almost a different sport, and you have to get that experience by being in that environment. And so I think that, you know, for the Hawks and the Hornets, they kind of have a similar goal this year, is get in, get as favorable as matchup as you can so you can get as deep as you might be able to get and get as much experience as possible. Because I don't think any reasonable fan of either team, you know, sees them being in the conference finals or anything like that. If that's what the general fan sees as being meaningful playoff basketball, is getting that far, very, very unlikely to happen. But that's not to say that they can't get a lot of rich experience from kind of getting in this year and measuring themselves up against other teams that have been there year in, year out for a while.
Let me think if there's something else to say. Thanks so much for coming on. Do you have anything you want to plug?
No, my writing goes out at P3 Hoops. I try to put a lot of X's and O's stuff out on Twitter. I'll do that kind of in fits and bursts. Sometimes I'll go a whole week and not have any time for it. Then the next week I might get quite a lot out. So that's what you're looking for, look me up. James, appreciate you having me on. Enjoyed it very much.
No problems. I'm just gonna quickly endorse Glenn. You know, yeah, again, best. Is Ed Kelly's real name Andrew?
That's right.
Okay, Andrew's awesome too. Andrew and Glenn, you know, what a twin towers that is for the Hawks analysis. But you know, not just saying because of the podcast appearance. So I got Glenn a little bit ahead. If Andrew wants to dispute that, come on, Beyond the Hype. You know, get us those extra Hawks clicks. But
Andrew's very good, awesome too. So
yeah, he's awesome. You guys are both seriously. Details, X's and O's. You're not gonna get much better in the game then. So yeah, chuck him a follow. And so I think that's it from us today at Beyond the Hive. And Aaron and Pete, please come back so I don't need to do this again, because it's probably a bit bumpy at times. So yeah, thanks for listening, everyone.